Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to episode 124, where we will discuss two works from Anshuman Prasad on postcolonialist theory. His 1997 article, Provincializing Europe Toward a Postcolonial Reconstruction, a Critique of Baconian Science as the Last Stand of Imperialism, and the 2003 book chapter, The Gaze of the Other, Postcolonial Theory and Organizational Analysis. To learn more about these texts, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Sam calling from Lisbon in Portugal.
And this is Pedro calling from Copenhagen in a beautiful sunny day. And I'm also glad to welcome here Anupama Kondaya from IIM Calcutta, who will be joining us in this episode. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Pedro. Thank you, everyone, for having me.
Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. Yes, I will. I'm at the Indian Institute of Management, Calcutta, in India, and I'm an assistant professor of organizational behavior. I deal with organizational structure and design over here in the group. We're in the eastern parts of India. My research also deals with the domain of organization theory, particularly organizational change, institutional change, with a focus on diversity, inclusion, and pluralism. And in that, my interest has been in bringing plural perspectives, indigenous and Indian perspectives, into management theorizing.
Okay, thanks. And that, of course, is the topic of conversation today. So what we have are two readings, and let me make sure I get the pronunciation correct, from Anshuman Prasad. And one is an article that he published from 1997, and the other is a book chapter, the leading book chapter of a volume that he edited in 2003, and this is about postcolonial theory. The first one is called Provincializing Europe Toward a Postcolonial Reconstruction, a Critique of Baconian Science and the Last Stand of Imperialism, which was published in the Studies of Cultures, Organizations, and Societies in 1997. And then, of course, the book chapter is a foundational analysis of postcolonial theory called The Gaze of the Other, Postcolonial Theory and Organizational Analysis. And this, of course, is a very important area of study for you, Anu. So why don't you go ahead and introduce us to the two works and we'll get the conversation going.
Yes. So it's a very interesting area of study in the sense that the idea of provincializing Europe that comes in not just with Anshuman Prasad's work, but he cites Diptesh Chakravarti's work a lot as well. The distinction with Anshuman Prasad's work, of course, is that he brings it into the domain of management and organization studies. So this idea of contesting universalism that seems to come in with modern management having its foundations in sort of Western philosophy and Western ideas was what changed the direction of management and org studies at that point. So these two readings together, I think, set the agenda in some sense. The first one talks about how we need to start looking at ideas, particularly of Baconian science. So Francis Bacon's ideas, which then foundationally feed into management science and organization studies, as local to those contexts. And there again, he distinguishes between the geographical idea of Europe and this hyperreal or symbolic idea of Europe, which then opens up space for bringing in other ideas and looking at sciences, other sciences that might exist in other parts, such that these universal ideas, which assumed universal ideas, which may or may not always serve the contexts, can then sort of start to get contextualized and applied in a manner that fits better to other contexts. So that is a larger idea. Of course, he gets into more foundational sort of philosophies of how then violence is sort of embedded in the idea of science. And that then is propagated through imperialism and colonialism to the rest of the world. Other post-colonial theorists have talked about the idea of the other, so the very creation of the other, but subsuming them into these universal ideas under that umbrella. So that is the first reading from 1997, which brought in very foundational ideas into the stream. The 2003 article supplements that, as you said, with one, a large overview of the four sort of streams that exist within post-colonial theory. So whether we talk about the very creation of the idea of the other and this dichotomy that we live with today, and the terms keep changing, whether it's the East or the West, the global North or the global South, but the idea of the other continues to exist in some form or another. So starting with ideas of Edward Said, who was the, in some sense, foremost formal post-colonial theorist, and there were so many others who resisted ideas of colonialism before. So starting with that, but also then getting into the psychology of colonialism through the works of Ashish Nandi, and getting into ideas of Homi Bhabha, who kind of talks about the hybridization as the foundation of his work, before getting into Gayatri Spivak's work, which is the whole field of subaltern studies and the subaltern collective. So this larger overview of the field that then informs how it is that it can inform current management and organization studies through this big idea of defamiliarization. So these two together then give us a key direction, which is one, to provincialize current ideas of management and organization studies, to open up space of bringing in other perspectives, use post-colonial theory and concepts to defamiliarize and hence see things in a different way, allowing for enriching current concepts.
Just a quick question, because this is not the sort of word that you hear very often in ordinary conversation, but what does provincialize mean?
Provincialize here is to basically contextualize. So Anshuman Prasad is contesting the supposed and assumed idea of universalism, the very foundational endeavor of creating the general and the universal is what is being contested here. To think of the ideas born in that symbolic and territorial geography as applicable to that geography, and then hence either relook at them or look at other philosophies that exist. That's the primary call that he puts out in the 1997 article by referring to the ideas of Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, for example, as to how the dichotomy between the idea of violence being embedded in the idea of science versus in the Eastern parts that he's familiar with, the idea of a holistic science, which is true and moral and ethical. So he's contesting the idea that Western science, by separating itself, calling itself objective, and then hence making a claim to generality, is somewhere doing disservice to the very idea of truth, because truth is very much loaded and value-laden in this situation, versus many other ideas that exist in other, both symbolic and territorial geographies, that can actually make us think of the truth itself very differently. And then how do you go about finding that truth? Is the idea of affect and emotion and ethics and morality in some sense contradictory or a barrier to the endeavor of finding the truth? And these are ideas that exist in other parts of the world. So by provincializing, the very claim to universality is being contested, and it is being contextualized and limited in some sense to the geographies where it has emerged.
And can I just say something about, because this idea of provincializing just made me go into this like kind of deep reflection. I think it's something that it's so familiar to, like, particularly us, like, scholars that grew up in a certain part of the world and then had to, like, move to other parts of the world to study and even work now in other parts of the world. I think we're, like, for us, it's so natural to understand that process of, like, when you arrive to completely different society, culture, whatever, and you become so aware of, you know, the things that you thought were universal when you were growing up. Now you see them, right, like, from far away, and you can be critical about them. And you, I don't know if it was the same for you guys, but you go through these, like, stage of everything, right? Everything that seemed normal, you kind of, you start to deconstruct and critically reflect on. And so And I don't know if that's the same for a lot of, for example, of the scholars, the European, in the sense that Prashad is using European, particularly in the article, that you don't necessarily maybe go through to these like having to go to, right, to a completely different place and like question all of your assumptions and stuff like that. So I think this is really, you know, I think it deserves that we pause on it and try to understand like what this process might look like, because that's what he's trying to do, right?
So a quick heuristic and a reflection. The heuristic I have for provincializing is just because I like sparkling wine. You know, I was fascinated when I discovered that only wine that comes from a particular place is champagne. Everything else is just sparkling. I'm like, interesting, right? Because that's how you make yourself unmarked and everyone else has been marked, right? And of course, people talk about this in many ways, especially in relation to, of course, some geographies and not just the physical geography, but the hegemonic ideas of a particular place that exist and circulate and justify the categories we use to think, but also the categories that are used for minorities, right? The other way you can think about that is, why do only gay people have to come out, right? And why we have Black History Month and not white, you know, all of these kind of differences that tend to make some people, some categories, some spaces as the other, and I'm using a quotations mark with my hands, versus the one that is taken for granted as being the universal, right? So he's subverting a little bit that in this process here.
If I can reflect on, I completely agree with Sam's thoughts here and Pedro's. I think to think a little more about the idea of provincializing and the universal versus when we actually get transplanted in different geographies or contexts, we discover that things don't actually work the way this larger discourse is telling us. I think what it also does, especially in post-colonial contexts and erstwhile colonized countries, is to create a split self. So there is this universal that we are internalizing in terms of global ideas that rule the discourse and very much in a hegemonic manner, as Pedro mentioned, and that idea of hegemony being very crucial and central to the entire post-colonial discourse. But these universal ideas that we internalize, adapt to, mold ourselves to, but also in our home contexts, so much of the praxis is informed by the local and the contextual. Sometimes there is a contradiction. And so what happens is, I think you end up separating the professional and the personal in some sense, or you create these two selves of yours. And that then begins to reflect everywhere. So the way you are in your personal private spheres versus the way you are in, you know, whether it is in our business schools, in our professional contexts, we interact with each other, it begins to reflect everywhere. And so the holism itself is sort of broken there to an extent.
Okay, so we've covered kind of the motivation behind the topic. Let's dive into the reading itself, because it's really a very complex space that he's occupying here, trying to take what is a rather broad and contested term itself, colonialism, actually two of them, colonialism and imperialism, and as having to try to define it and define it in such a way that it makes sense for the particular form of colonialism that he's referring to, in this case, the universality of Europe and the expansion of Europe across the world in a particular time. There is a lot to unpack in this. And the other thing is the perspective in which he takes. And I want to highlight one of the first passages that I started when I read this. And this is my first reading of these articles. Never read them before. While colonialism was indeed marked by a diverse range of practices, the overriding consequence of such practices, and this is emphasis original, as far as the colonized peoples were concerned, was broadly the same, to wit, the attempted dominations and subjugation of the colonized. Which I thought was interesting because, yes, when we think of how the European influence spread during this period, there were multiple fronts of it. There was a military aspect, there was a scientific aspect, there was an intellectual aspect, there was a cultural...
Religious,
there you go. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I mean, it was all of these fronts, but... From the perspective of those being colonized, it all kind of looked or felt the same. It served to marginalize or subordinate them them to the colonizers. So I thought that that was important. And we'll get to, I suppose we'll get to what he means by post-colonialism in a bit. In particular, he's focusing on Baconian science, because science, as we understand it now, is different than, say, the Baconian science, in which science was a tool. I mean, it was basically a tool, cultural expansion that saw a particular, that was basically being imposed upon these cultures and was justifying, was among the ways of justifying the colonial expansion.
Just a quick thing, maybe, because before we jump into the details, I just want to flag that we have explored some of these questions in the context of Latin America and epistemic coloniality, right, with the work of Barra Collado on episode 7. I think that the very reason that we have these episodes and we are trying to make sense of all of this and, you know, understanding the terms and what it means and so on, is because our canon, which is a lot of what we cover in the podcast, right, has been produced in those conditions, right? So I think it's also important for us to just do a moment of reflection that, in a way, what Prasad is trying to do is to expand and context and contest, not just contextualize, also the what we take as to be canonical, right? Which has universalized what it means to organize in a particular way and forms of organization and concepts we use and theories and understanding, right? So in a way, just to say that even we could do the same exercise that we'll be doing here, the episodes that we did in the past, right? And we already started that to some extent in that episode we did. So just to flag that.
Yes. When I was reading this work, which I was also not familiar with before, like I kicked myself. We should have done this episode before Ibarra Collado, right? Because a lot of I went back to Ibarra Collado and I noticed that he cites his work everywhere, and he's, in a way, he's responding to Prasad's call of, right, like trying to be more critical of organization theory, organizational analysis. And so, yeah, if you haven't listened to the Ibarra Collado episode, maybe listen to this one first and then go to that one. And I think also just another point before we dive in, which is we should also try to define clearly to our listeners what Prasad's notion of European and modern are, just because, you know, he has this statement at the beginning of his paper clarifying what he means by this. And I think it's important for our discussion as well that he's treating Europe as an idea rather than a geographical fixity, he says, right? So I love this, like, really kind of slightly confusing sentence, but I think illustrates what I was trying to say. So there are Europeans, white, situated in and belonging to a geographical space commonly designated as Europe, who are non-Europeans, and non-Europeans, non-white, situated outside the geographic Europe, who may be Europeans. And it's the same for modern, right? It's this idea of, yeah, he's trying to also use it not of a particular point in time, but also of what it represents. Yes, when we use that in the episode, I think we should try and be faithful to what Prasad was trying to say as well.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with that. To me, the phrase state of mind was very important in that sense. So treating these not as moments in history or time, but truly as psychologies and states of mind and ideas, I think, that we have adopted. So I think thinking of Europe or the West or the modern in that sense, I think, is crucial here when we talk about these ideas.
Another thing we should mention as a kind of introduction is especially thinking about both texts at the same time before we go into the article first, probably. I think it's two things that Prasad is proposing. So one of them is to be critical in the way in which we produce knowledge in general. And I think this is, this goes beyond organization studies. And the second one does have to do a little bit more with organization studies, which is being critical of the way we understand organizational phenomena. So it's, I think, you have these two things that he's trying to accomplish at two different levels. Yeah.
Yes. Which is why I think the order is also very interesting. The 97 article sets a much larger stage by contesting the very idea of science, even with the disclaimer that the way we think of science today is very different from the way we thought about it now at that point. But again, certain core ideas, the essence, I think, is what he's referring to, which remains part of the larger discourse and drives a lot of the endeavor of science even today. So that larger stage gets set in 1997, and then it gets much more clarified in terms of an agenda for our field in 2003. And so it'll be very interesting to discuss the larger stages, as I said, the way we produce knowledge itself, being critical of that, examining that afresh before kind of contextualizing it, so to speak, to our field.
Okay, so I think we can start unpacking then this 97 article. We should cover it first because it is a big stage setter. I mean, it basically goes back to why did colonialism happen in the first place? On the one hand, it'd be one thing to talk about the tools of colonialism, and it begins largely with a critique or a rereading of James Mill's 1820 History of British India. And a lot of what Prasad is pulling out from it are sort of the indicators of this notion of European universality and looking down upon non-Europeans. And in this particular case, of course, India. And he's not pulling punches here. This is a pretty direct and strong critique. He highlights, for example, how Mill marginalized Hindu culture. Some of the major Hindu poems and epics, such as Ramayana and the Mahabharata, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, were, quote, trifling and childish to a degree with those acquainted with only European poetry could hardly conceive. Taking that as one example among many in a very lengthy passage to show sort of like the attitude of the European as the superior and finding reasons to denigrate the other in order to say that we need to go in and save this civilization. And he even, Prasad, even drew out somewhere in here the passage from Mill that was, you know, that was like the ultimate argument. And I can't remember which page that was on. By using this, and again, it was a very lengthy passage to show what the thought process was behind colonialization. And so then, what was the basis of the terms of universality? Now, I thought it was a little bit weird that he took a break and then went into defining post-colonialism before talking about the impacts of Baconian science. So I would recommend we focus on the part on Baconian science before we get into post-colonialism, because Baconian science is kind of like the tool in use, the one that he's particularly critical of, because this is where the intellectual thought and the epistemic colonization comes from.
I do want to kind of spend a minute or two on precisely the part that you highlighted, Tom, the quote about the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. These are known to be the longest epic poems in the world in existence, and many fold longer than Greek works of similar nature. What was very interesting to me was the quote before that. And this is again with reference to the universalism and something that Pedro mentioned, which is what categories do we use and how we use them? The idea of poetry being a sign of being at the early stages of civilization. So the quote reads on page number 95 of this article, "The first literature is poetry. Poetry is the language of the passions, and men feel before they speculate. The earliest poetry is the expression of the feelings by which the minds of rude men are the most powerfully actuated. At this first stage, the literature of the Hindus has always remained." This is from the 1820 work of Mill, and emphasis has been added. Now, it is interesting to think about this quote and then the assessment of these two epic poems in that regard. If one looks at the texts and literature produced in that period in ancient India, whether it was scientific texts, texts of literature or art, every one of them was largely written as poetry. So very concise two-line verses set in a particular meter. So the entire work would follow the same meter, no matter how many thousand of these sort of couplets were there. But ideas of science, ideas of art, dramaturgy were captured in these. So if you might be familiar with yoga and the ideas of Patanjali and Yoga Shastra, which talks about the approach and principles of yoga, which has now become such a global phenomenon. all of these works are written in a poetic meter. And so my thought process would be exactly the opposite, to take all of these fields and domains and the knowledge in these fields, to set them to a particular meter and then compose these works would arguably require high levels of sophistication or advancement or understanding at the very least. So it's very interesting to me that this quote associates poetry purely with emotion or passion. So that quite struck me in this work.
Yes, and I think it gets to, I think, one of my favorite things about reading this text, which is his challenge of, you know, the truth as being this kind of unbiased, unpassionate, right? Like thing, and completely separated from beauty, right? And just the way like he challenges this assumption for me was, yeah, I think was great.
I mean, just a quick unrelated but related thought, right? On how this is spread, the way in which we may use some categories to then devalue some things because they're associated with particular people, right? Just think all of the things that we do internally, and even ex-colonies will do to local expression of culture, right? That some of them that would be related to indigenous people would be seen as folklore versus the real culture of, you know, particular forms of dance and rhythm and whatever, right? So that is also, it's done not just geopolitical level, but also within differences that are done by elites in a particular country that may represent the metropolis versus expressions that are related to indigenous population and so on and so forth. Listening to you both just made me think of that.
Yeah. It, by the way, the passage I was looking for that was sort of like the concluding one, it was actually the next paragraph in, at the top of page 96, which is where Mills provides his summary. For us reading it now, it's laughable, but it is certainly consistent with the derivation of it given in the highlighted in the previous passages, concluding that the Hindu religion was primitive, depraved, immoral, because it subjects to the eyes of its votaries the grossest image of sensual pleasure and renders even the emblems of generation objects of worship. He claimed that these have been cultivated exclusively for the purpose of astrology, one of the most irrational of all imaginable pursuits, one of those which most infallibly denote a nation barbarous. With that as sort of like the sum, it's hard not to imagine why there would be this sense of superiority that sort of drove the movement to colonize. So laughable now because we know so much more about the world, but I can sort of empathize with the notion of if you were living in an isolated bubble, and I've been in a lot of places where people live in isolated bubbles, the tendency to other, this is about as stark an example as you can come up with, but it's amazingly consistent with how othering just ordinarily happens.
So we may not want to go through all the details and every quote and so on, but one important thing to say at this point is that, of course, he has this, pulls all of this, you know, ways in which the Indians are talked about by Mills and so on. But he also then say that some of the good guys with air quotes, right, and or the people that have expressed more liberal or even anti-hegemonic and pro-liberation ideas were victim a little bit of this, right? So basically to say that how widespread and taken for granted, he talks of Hegel, which of course underpins a lot of Western thought, including Marx, and he talks about Marx himself as well, and John Stuart Mill, which is of course this, you know, one of the heroic figures about the idea of democracy and representative government, right? And you start to, you know, see that representative government, yes, but one of the things that struck me is that the idea of Mills was that could only be done in colonies in which there are basically white people, right? Like in the US. But if you are in a place like India, it's totally justifiable to have any kind of stark domination and authority. He really drives home the point that it was not just a few bad apples that had this thought, but how it was widespread across the canon, again, to use that term.
Yes. And I love the critique that he makes to like critical scholarship or in particular, I mean, he does that in both texts, but in this one, I remember discovering, you know, postmodernism and like all the critical authors and stuff, like back when I was doing my undergraduate degree and just like reading his interpretation of this work now through the lens of post-colonial theory, like it was like, yeah, you're absolutely right. Right. Like, so he makes a criticism to these authors and to these kind of schools of thought.
I think in that vein, what was even more idea that all of the scholars, no matter what their thought process, including Marx, for example, took this idea of progress and this end goal of civilization as a given, ideas of science, ideas of progress, ideas of modernity as a given, that was uncontested. I had to take a minute to grapple with that. But the other thing is, and we've been talking about India and how the Indians or the what they call the Hindus were looked at. But further, I think there's a quote also about, you know, Africa. So the fact that even amongst the others, they were not equal. In fact, so then creating this sort of, you know, division, one is the aristocratic elite in the sort of colonizing geographies, the others, but in that also some others not even being sort of, you know, worthy of discussion in some sense. And what that does precisely to what Sam was saying earlier, to the knowledges that come from these parts, how do we look at those, right? How do we even begin to bring that into the fold? What knowledge is embedded in the way they communicate with each other? What Pedro was saying about folklore, etc. So if you don't even validate certain geographies as worthy of discussion, what does that even mean for all the knowledge that comes from there and how we then go about finding out the truth? That was also something that I had to sort of process when I read that.
In the passage titled Baconian Science and Europe, so we now start to see the roots of where Baconians, you know, how Baconian science is defined. I'll highlight Husserl's passage that he quotes. On his confidence of the capability of such science, this type of objective universal science, to produce absolute theoretical insights whose aim is to elevate, very important verb there, elevate mankind through universal scientific reason. And then he goes on to talk about Kuhn, Thomas Kuhn, who wrote or Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And in a section entitled Revolutions in Relativism, he draws this block from Kuhn. Applied to culture and its development, my position is relativistic, but applied to science, it may not be, and it is in any case far from mere relativism. Practitioners of the developed science are fundamentally puzzle solvers, though the values that they deploy at times of theory choice derive from other aspects of their work as well. The demonstrated ability to set up and to solve puzzles presented by nature is, in the case of value conflict, the dominant criterion for most members of a scientific group. Now, what I took away from that passage, which was a really, and we haven't not covered Thomas Kuhn's book in this program, but we have had it on our list for a while, and stay tuned, you may hear it in a forthcoming episode. But I found that that was a very, very interesting take to sort of explain why science becomes not just a matter of pursuing truth, but instilling a sense of adventure. And the sense of adventure itself tends to encourage people to jump on, go find something new, and not inflict it, but inflict is not the right word. It's something much softer. But for it to make its way around the world, to inform and to and in the pursuit of the ultimate truth, the subjectivity of the subjects themselves get overlooked or passed over or overlooked. I think that's about the best way to put it.
Yes, I think what struck me about that quote was this idea of puzzle solving. I think elsewhere they also talk about the instrumentality of it. So one is, yes, Tom, as you said, this sense of adventure, but the other is also then science in service of something else. So on the one hand, we talk about the truth. So the finding of the truth, that endeavor or even that adventure should not be contingent ideally on an instrumental end. And in this case, I think he's building up this case that it was serving the endeavor of colonizing. So this instrumentality, the moment that comes into ideas of science, what that does and how that reflects in our contemporary times was something I found very thought-provoking. In the sense that science has to be in service of mankind, yes, but who decides what those puzzles are, which ones are worthy? And that discourse continues even today, which problems are worth solving, what they signal. So this instrumentality and hence the link between science and colonialism. That was quite stark. And then the whole project becomes sort of open. And I can talk about a little bit about my research in terms of when this is at the period when Western science and specifically Western medicine comes to India, at which point in the Indian subcontinent, I don't want to say India, Indian subcontinent, this geography, there are a couple of traditional medical systems, what we call today traditional medical systems, in existence. And understandably, as the article indicates, the idea of truth based on the philosophies in these medical systems is different from what Western science and Western medicine would have held as the sort of the ontology of truth. The sources of knowledge that are privileged are very different. So there is this big encounter that happens between these different sciences, so to speak. And I do talk about it a little bit in my research in terms of the fact that in Western science and philosophy, we privilege only two ways of knowing, which is, you know, like you privilege your senses and then, of course, logic and deduction. But in many other scientific philosophies, there are as many as six or more ways of knowing. And when there is that fundamental difference, a conversation or an exchange requires so much more of an effort. So conflict is so much more of a possibility over there. So that moment in history when Western medicine is traveling to these parts and this encounter happens, and then you really see the ferment, these ideas, these claimed universal ideas that are being brought to the colonies, and what that does to the traditional medical systems, which understand the truth, human values, and in my context, human bodies itself very differently. So the ways of approaching, even if it's solving the same puzzle, the ways of approaching the solution are so different. So you do see that happening. So again, that was something that was in my mind.
We probably want to know more about that in a second part. But going back to the text, one thing that is a bit striking is, of course, historically, we know there has been a lot of silencing, marginalizing of ways of knowing, right? But what is interesting is that going back to the quote that Tom was sharing about this whole idea of in the service of mankind and so on, mankind, as Prasad tells us, was meant to mean the gentry of Britain, right? The aristocracy, a very specific sliver of humanity, right? It's the same thing when in the Declaration of Constitution in the US, they say we the people, right? It's a very particular type of people that they were referring to. Written from our eyes like this, I think many people would be, we would agree, would be very aligned with, you know, some of the ideas that we have in terms of human rights, but that's not what was meant. And then he says, of course, that this idea of power over nature, which was, you know, part of the quote as well, nature could include human beings because, surprise, surprise, humans were more human than others, and some of were seen as part of nature, and some humans were understood to have soul or no souls, or being human or more or less human. Then you could subject certain populations, some groups, right, to all sort of not just epistemic violence, but also direct physical violence and studies and investigations and all. And he tells, of course, stories about that, right? That's a little bit chilling.
I would then follow that down to the later section on page 108, which really kind of ties everything together very neatly. And again, this is a quote that Prasad pulled from Bacon himself, and it's at the bottom of page 108, which knowledge and human power are synonymous. So there, now what we're starting to see is the end game, if you will. It's not just a matter of the pursuit of knowledge for higher good, but also because it increases the power one has. And so this is where he really gets into the meat of his thesis of science as an instrument of violence. It's not just physical violence, it's also cultural disruption and imposition of other ideas on a not necessarily willing culture. So he goes through that discourse, and again, it's a very lengthy discourse, basically proving, if you will, that particular statement about the linkage between knowledge, power, and how it played out in the spread of science. So then he concludes the 1997 paper, it's After Science / the Post-Scientific World. He asks a question, you know, okay, So if you're going to deconstruct it, what would a deconstructed world look like? And he gives an indication of that. And he draws from Lyotard and others. And sort of in a way, this gets into this 2003 article because he's drawing from postmodernism at this point. And he gives postmodernism a real wire brushing in the 2003 book chapter because he sees postcolonialism as very different from postmodernism. But he doesn't actually describe very much. As a matter of fact, he says in the last paragraph, I do not intend to presume to provide here the final details of the project of inventing the new universalism. But he does try to set the stage for saying that it's not going to be necessarily the absence or the removal of science. It's going to be something different from that. He quotes Nandi as the true enemy of thesis is seen to be the synthesis because it includes the thesis and ends the latter's reason for being. If the new universalism merely inverts science, that is to replace Baconian science with some other form, it would still be inseparably tied to the very science it desires so much to overcome. That being the case, the new universalism, while including Nitschke's lion, will fundamentally be based upon Nitschke's child, who says the sacred yes. So the project remaining one of provincializing Europe is essentially to remove these vestiges, like say, okay, we need to get rid of or set aside Baconian science and seek something else. He doesn't necessarily,
I understood something different. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, let me know what you guys understood. But by that, which I also loved, is not we're going to get rid of European science or Baconian science. But we're just going to acknowledge that as something that exists in a wider universe that where all of their things, just as legitimate, also exist. That's what I understood. So it's not we're going to create the anti or, you know, right, like exactly the opposite of Baconian science. We're not going to eliminate Baconian science. We're just going to acknowledge that it's one of many different ways of creating knowledge.
You said it a whole lot better than I did.
My takeaway actually was twofold. One was that this precise hegemony of science. So in some ways, it sounded a little bit like you can never actually get rid of it because then every synthesis and then, you know, as the dialectic continues, will have vestiges of this surviving. And maybe that's what we're seeing play out today. So in some way, I understood it as the fact that this may never go away, even though other perspectives are brought in some. So that was my primary sort of understanding of that.
Yes, which I think it goes in line with the idea of provincializing, right? Like it's not, you're not going to eliminate the province. You're just going to acknowledge that there are other there are other provinces as well. I mean, I think his attack is not, I mean, definitely he's critical of Baconian science, but it's not that it's the universalization of that that he's attacking, that he's trying to destroy. It's the idea that, you know, we need to understand that that's not it. That's not truth with capital T. Like there's other ways and we need to understand all. I mean, and I think this becomes clear also in the book chapter. With the idea of differentiation is by having other ways of knowing that then you can understand like all the ways in which all the things that you were not seeing in that dominant kind of paradigm, right?
That is most certainly a more hopeful way of looking at it because my understanding, which I will readjust now, was that ideas of Baconian science might actually just keep on playing out because they'll always exist in the synthesis. So this is a much more hopeful way of looking at it.
I mean, I originally didn't understand it exactly like that, but when Sam said it, I kind of understood and kind of, you know, everything clicked. So that's why one of the reasons why we keep doing the podcast is exactly that we learn also in the process of dialoguing. But what was clear to me is that his critique, he has a critique of the defenses of science, right? Because they say, of course, he's not the first one to critique science and Baconian science and all that, because especially in light of the experiments in humans done in Nazism, which of course he says that is just the end of a process, it's not just a thing in itself. But there was an internal critique, let's put it that way, right? And then he says, well, all of the response to the critique have always, in a way or the other, used the bad apple argument, right? So it's there is real science and there is, you know, the good science, there is the bad science, right? There is pure science and there is like a technology or applied science, right? There is science as an ideal thing and then how it's practiced in particular context, which always lets Voconian science or science as understood through Western frames off the hook and it's staying universal, right? So every time it's good, it's universal, and that's the one. And every time there is a problem, oh, that's just bad for a particular person or context or situation or application that it is. And going to the idea of provincializing that he starts with and that some articulated very well, it shows exactly, well, no. We have to also to accept the critique, right? And so not only see there are multiple ways of doing, but also understanding that that way of doing can lead to such things, that they are not perversion of that, but they're inherent. They're just carrying it to its consequences to the utmost level, right? So that's what he's trying to put it back. So to speak, to then say that, you know, there is space for others instead of always saying, every time it's good, this is the one that we meant to, you know, express, and all the others are just, you know, particularities that are verses that are wrong. So he's trying to get away with this framing and way of thinking.
I was very struck by that sentence now that you highlight that part of the paper. And it reminded me of another excellent sort of reading. The sentence on page 112, that modern science is the new orthodoxy which can tolerate no dissent. As you said, so it's so tautological. If it is good, it is science. If it is not, it was never science in the first place, in some sense. And it also reminds me of the reading by Roger Friedland, where he again talks about how science has come to be the exact thing that it was protesting against in the first place, the whole dogmatic nature of science in some sense today. So that really jumped out at me now that you kind of mentioned that section.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.